Okay, so Dominic, how did you first, I suppose, hear of magic, get into magic, or even did you call it magic when you first started on this path?
So I would say I was probably into magic before I even knew what magic was by virtue of being like training in Aikido, for example. I've been training in Aikido for 9 years. And then I started getting into Qigong as like a supplemental practice for like health and wellness and physical capacity. So, you're doing all these visualizations and breathing techniques, but I wasn't necessarily into magic per se. But as a kid, I always had like magical inclinations, like enchantment and nature and whatnot. But it wasn't until I started getting into meditation practice and then with the aim to pursue awakening, a Buddhist awakening, and really hitting meditation hard. And then all of a sudden, the lid blew off and then magic became really obviously a thing. So then, you know, as we do these days, just went on the internet, on Reddit, and just going down the many rabbit holes. So
Yeah. So like when you said then as a child, as you know, you're doing kind of enchantments and going to the like was forests and stuff. What did that look like? What exactly was going on now?
Well, I mean, so I meant like having a sense of enchantment rather than doing enchantment. So it's like,
so you weren't going to the forest and, you know, making voodoo dolls or doing anything like that.
Not quite yet. But although I do remember when my mom got remarried as a kid and we moved out into the country in New York, she had like this one occult book that was like from the 70s or 60s or something. And I don't remember what the title is, but it had like a sigil on the front that was like green and blue and yellow, looked scary as fuck. So I was like, so like, it was like one of those things where the book exudes like this aura and I was like kind of afraid to look at it. But I remember like my dad would take me, like we would drive out to Barnes and Noble because at that time there wasn't one close by, and I remember like seeing all these spooky books and I was always like too afraid to look at it, but I still felt like the draw to it, which was funny.
But what climate were, I suppose, were you in? Like, what were your parents? Were they religious, not religious, atheists? Were they...
my parents were, they were raised Catholic, but they never, we basically went to church a handful of times as a kid. And they didn't really push anything on me at all. It was very non-religious, but so it was super chill environment in that regard.
But were they open to like kind of weird ideas, or was it just a non-issue? Like it just wasn't
not really. Yeah, I mean, my parents aren't that strange or into weird stuff. Like they weren't like into the Theosophical Society or anything. But like, but you know, like they've always been really open-minded and supportive. So that was like, you know, whatever weird shit I did as a teen and there onwards, they didn't really bat an eye. So.
So was there any kind of contemporaries that you had at school or anything that were like, was there anyone who was mad into Aleister Crowley or anything like that? Or was it, you know, all just fairly...
No, as a kid, it was like, you know, like I hung out with like, you know, like the skater crowd. So like it was, you know, amongst others. So like everybody was like into heavy metal and you know, but I actually never had any exposure to like Aleister Crowley or any of the other big, well-known magical people, even for like the... edgelord, we're gonna read these books because we're naughty and we smoke cigarettes under the bleachers or what have you. But I did play Magic the Gathering a bit. so that's what comes to mind. But yeah, it wasn't really until much later, you know, and I think a lot of it has to do with like the time that I were in and like when all the new atheists came out, you know, like there's a fairly dominant, you know, like 9/11 happened and it's like atheism was like really dominant in like my social sphere and exposure.
No, I totally get it because mine like was absolutely dissimilar. Like at one point, it just felt like everyone was like this kind of militant atheist, and then there was me going, "Hello." Although, you know, so you kind of felt that you couldn't talk about it, I suppose, a bit, or not that you couldn't talk about it, you just didn't want to, you know, because you knew what the answer was.
Yeah, and I just sort of felt like, you know, like I think what ends up happening is. That as a child, like that unconditioned like sense of wonder or like whatever people claim is like the consciousness of a child that's like fresher or more in touch with the divine or the magical qualities of reality, you know, like as you grow older, that sort of gets conditioned out. Like you have to become, you know, a productive member of society, and you can't entertain all these, like, you know,
you have to grow up and stop having childish ideas and this kind
of, you know,
thing.
Religion is the upbeat of the masses and stuff, that sort of thing. But I don't think it's any coincidence then, like, eventually, like, you know, always loving art, music, poetry, literature, you know, like, still being in touch with, like, a sense of wonder that is magical, like, especially poetry. Like, my relationship to poetry is much different than it used to be. Like, oh, this is artistic and beautiful, but, you know, like, the magician, you know, speaks poetry as the champion, you know, incantation. So,
spells.
Spells, exactly.
So then what would have been the first initial, I suppose, calling of the silent knowing, if you want to speak in Magia terms, but, like, what was the first reason to go looking for something that wasn't the world as it was presented? You know, what was your kind of Neo moment where you realized that there was a splinter in your brain?
Yeah, so it was like 2015 and 2016, you know, I was in a former relationship, and things started to get very contracted. Like, there was, like, you know, coming to these impasses, and at one point, like, you know, there was issues in our relationship, and then my partner proposed to me at the time, but then, like, I was like, no, like, this is not the right course of action. And even though I love that person very much and I really wanted to work it out, and that was like around 2016.
Okay.
And then at some point, like, I just was super depressed. I became, like, very, very, very depressed. And I was like, you know, for me, like, I've never, like, entertained, like, suicidal ideation or anything, but there was a point where I was just like, if I could just stop existing, like, that would be awesome. Cause,
like, was it like, if I don't wake up in the morning, I'm kind of okay with that, but I'm not going to do anything about it, sort of thing.
Totally. Like, it could be like cryogenic stasis for, like, you know, a decade or so and be okay with that. And so, but there was a part of me that was like, well, I know in the past that, like, you know, it brings up childhood again, like, you know, that earlier in my life, there was times where I was happy and that this was wrong. It was wrong to feel this way, this darkness, this grayness. And so at that point, I just sort of had in my mind that, like, it was just like some sort of intuition that I was like, I'm going to find the answer. And so then I basically started going on Reddit, looking at the meditation subreddit, and then through that, started hearing about this thing called the Progress of Insight, which is, you know, a Theravadan map in Buddhism. And, you know, and then there's this group of people that were like, oh, you can become awakened. It's not like this fantasy. You could actually do this in your life.
In your lifetime. Yeah. It's not 500 lifetimes and all this. Yeah.
Yeah.
That seems a pretty big jump, though, from feeling depressed to getting on Reddit and then to suddenly finding this. Like, well, had you an awareness of meditation before that, any sort of a practice, or did you just find yourself in the deep end, literally, I suppose?
Oh, so, I mean, over the years, like, I would say, like, you know, when yoga became a thing, you know, just trying yoga for a little bit, and then, like, you know, mindfulness started becoming really popular in the public, you know, in the mid-2000s, and, you know, that's obviously, it's starting to wane quite a bit now. If you go to the supermarket or whatever, you don't see as many publications, you know, knowing about mindfulness, and then because of Aikido, like, knowing about like the somatic practices and breath meditations and Qigong, and, you know, and then, you know, just never really doing yoga that seriously, never doing like mindfulness, you know, I would do like 10 or 15 minutes, like, every once in a while. And I was like, okay, I can get some sort of space. And it just never really seemed, I just never knew what it could be. I just sort of took it at face value. Like, oh, like, you can be calmer, you can be happier, you can be, you know, a little more chill. So then, you know, I started practicing Qigong and starting to notice a lot of interesting stuff happening. but nothing too crazy, just like energetic stuff, you know. And that was in my wheelhouse because of Aikido training.
Sure. Yeah.
And then from then I started to, because of Reddit, you know, started to read the Zen subreddit, which is known as for being a garbage dump, but it was still super
You could say that about all of Reddit, in fairness. You know, it's a bit of a, it's an interesting place, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's been so instrumental for me in a lot of ways, but it's unpalatable at this point in a lot of regards. But so then I started reading a lot of the, you know, the Chinese Zen masters, and then it sort of fed into learning about like these old Buddhist maps. And so, yeah, there was definitely context around it. And
yeah,
so,
yeah. So like, what was your meditation practice looking like when you get on, you know, you started getting to this where you, you know, did you go 20 minutes a day? Was it like straight into 10 hours a day? Were you going on, you know, 20 day silent retreats, or, you know, was it a very, was it more of a slow kind of gradual getting into it?
No, it was like, because, you know, because I was living through such a, like, the, it just felt intolerable for like a little while, like for such a long time, that like there was this part of me that was like, no. And so basically I just jumped into it. At around that time when I started learning about pragmatic Dharma, a book called The Mind Illuminated had come out at the time. And it was,
Oh, yeah.
So basically it was perfect because it was like, not only is awakening in this lifetime possible, but here's this book that you can go through stages, and there's like specific things to focus on and specific drills. And this is when you know you're able to move on to the next stage. And so it was like a very clear training program that was allowing me to really plug into something without like a very strong container that would allow me to develop the discipline to support a practice that really quickly became like an hour a day, at least. So initially it started off, I was like doing 30 minutes to 45 minutes. And then eventually, because like, I was like, I don't give a shit about anything else right now. It felt so urgent and so important to actually respond to the call to do this, which in hindsight, it's just sort of like, well, why did I have so much faith that this would be the thing?
Yeah. Yeah. That, like, I mean, it is an interesting, you know, like, because usually in kind of those places, the dark places, whatever, there's the hard bit is to get kind of have this trusting or this fate or something like that. But it seems to have been, I don't know, just, was it just that it was out of necessity that he says, I have to trust that at least something will work? Or was it more in knowing that this was the way out of the darkness? Say, at some deep kind of level.
Yeah, I just, because I saw it as an answer, because I was sort of like, well, something is wrong in me, with me, like in how I'm relating to my life in this relationship. And then that ended up, that relationship ended up, we ended up separating. So it ended up taking a different course than I expected. But I was like, when I look back in retrospect, I sort of see like taking on this specific style of practice as a magical act, because in the book, they frame, there's a framework. It's like a 6-step process. Like you sit down, you state your intention, why you're doing this, what you're hoping to accomplish. There's like a variety of different details that you sort of align yourself with.
Yeah.
So basically it's like, oh, I'm setting this intention. So my intention would be like, it was very prayerful too. I'd be like, I'm doing this so that I could, you know, like repair my relationship and awaken and like be of a benefit to all beings, you know. It was like very intense. And so I felt like the energy of that really carried me through. So I didn't really encounter a lot, like I feel very fortunate because I didn't really encounter a lot of the frustrations of practice that a lot of people encounter. Like it's boring, or like my mind's not quiet. And then they see that as the marker of success is like pure quiet, when like, that's not really what about.
But know, I think that, that it's kind of the Google mindfulness thing that came out, kind of, I think that's where an awful lot that, that mistake came from, that people assumed that you had to have this quiet mind. And I go, oh, I can't meditate because I have too many thoughts. And they go, yes, yes, you do. That's the point. But what the actual meditation thing is, realizing that you've all these thoughts, like, and that's the thing that's pointed at.
and you're like, you've just sort of like, you've just decided you would turn down the volume knob on all this stuff that's shouting at you in the other room. And then meditation is just like, oh, having some sense of what's actually going on. So because of the energy that I had, it was just thrown into with practice and, you know, really believing in it, it started to get weird really quickly.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Define weird.
So what became, you know, so I was practicing the Mind Illuminated, which is a shamatha and vipassana system, but then I would incorporate a lot of metta because I felt like, because my heart felt so dry and not alive, I would incorporate the Mind Illuminated and I would do metta. And then I would do...
I think it might be helpful to explain those terms to people who probably don't, you know, wouldn't be too familiar with them. Because it's more like...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so if you could... Or at least your understanding of what they are. Like metta, yeah, so, for instance, which is the loving kindness, like kind of, or whatever.
So shamatha is referred to as calm abiding, concentration practice, which a lot of people, as time have gone on, have contested because it, like, implies, like, this laser focus. But... reality, and it's, I think it's more helpful to think of it as a settling, like the mind starts to settle. And that's usually done like through breath meditation, like you're breathing in, breathing out, and then the mind starts to quiet. And then you get into more absorption states that are pleasant, peaceful, enjoyable. And then Vipassana is translated as like insight practice, which is like the looking, you're looking at what the mind is doing. So there's a whole list of different ways this is done. Metta is loving kindness. So this is, I see it as a prayer, you know, like you basically say like, may the world, you know, may I be well, may I be at ease, may I be peaceful. You know, you, even though a lot of times people have a very dry relationship to metta, eventually it starts to lubricate and become joyful. And that's how you start to cultivate like the positive mind states of love and kindness.
Particularly when you start expressing it towards people you dislike or have trouble with, or that kind of thing. And it starts as being hard to do, and then you realize it's less hard to do. You know, that's kind of, at least that's how I found it anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times, you know, it depends. Like, teachers will often tell students who are struggling with this, they have to try different things. Like, so maybe like it's hard. Like, sometimes people find it really easy to express that to other people, even if they don't like those people, but they have trouble expressing it towards themselves.
Yes.
Or if they have like a family member that they don't like, that's super triggering and they can't do that. Or some people, they'll just be like, you should do it with your pet, you know, think of your pet, because a lot of times people can contrive a strong sense of love and appreciation for their pet. So
So when you were saying you were combining these things, was it in the sense of in the same practice, like you were breaking up your hour or half hour, what you're doing into, I would start, you know, and then I would go into Vipassana or go into some sort of noting technique and end with metta? Or was it like, today I'm doing metta, tomorrow I'm doing noting practice? Or
So basically what I would do is I would usually spend like 20 minutes or so doing the metta practice to sort of quiet everything down. And then I would do the Mind Illuminated for 40 to 50 minutes.
Okay.
Because it's the shamatha heavy focus, like it's easy to like kind of smooth that out. And then usually at the end, I would do 10 to 20 minutes of the noting practice.
Okay.
And since I didn't define that, it's basically just whenever something arises in your awareness, you note it. So if, you know, itchy butt or, you know, I'm drowsy, you know, you just rapidly just noticing whatever up, ache in the back, you know, oh, pleasant sensation in the heart, you know, and then just indiscriminately just cycling through those until stuff happens. So I basically, my attitude was like, well, a lot of people online are like, well, you shouldn't mix practices. So what I did was like, I'll just treat each practice of a technique as a discrete practice period, and then just add them all together. So this ended up becoming up to 2 hours, right? But
oh wow, yeah.
So it would be super enjoyable though. Because then like it would sort of, you know, like these things would link together, and then clearly I could trust the fact that what I was doing was working because it was really obviously so.
Right. Because you said it got weird quick. So what did you start finding? What was the weirdness?
So In the progress of insight, you know, it tracks different points that you will encounter. And at some point it gets this rough patch. So this is often referred to as the Dark Night of the Soul, which isn't, you know, there's like some cross-cultural mixing going on there because, know, that term wasn't found within Buddhism, but this is the Dukkha Jhana. So basically it would be like disgust, misery, you know, there's all these different ones that sound pretty terrible. But what I noticed when this was encountering me, because I was so depressed, in contrast, when I was encountering these things in practice, which became pretty evident to me, like it was actually pretty novel. It ended up being rather psychedelic at times.
Okay.
So like, I remember I would see stuff vibrating and I would see like little, I would see various images and shadows and, I would smell things that weren't there. Like there was just no reason that there was no accounting for a certain smell that I would have.
Pleasant and unpleasant. Was it pleasant and unpleasant?
Oh no, it was just purely unpleasant.
Okay.
So it was like this. It was like during disgust. I remember it smelled like rotting corpses.
Oh no! Like that. Oh no!
So like it was just stuff that was like super weird because I'd be sitting in my room or whatever, and like there was no accounting for that. And then also like I remember like hearing like a variety of different tones layered upon each other. So I'd hear like four or five different distinct tones.
Okay.
And it was super eerie. Right.
Was this all happening within the practice? Was there anything happening like in your day-to-day life that was kind of equally weird?
It was happening in both.
Both, so, right. Okay, yeah.
So like it would happen, like I would be at work and then I would hear these eerie tones and it was like, oh, this is like, it was kind of sinister. But it was so unusual, I wasn't actually afraid of it. So, you know, you can imagine if people were like, oh, I'm going to do mindfulness-based stress reduction, then all of a sudden they get thrown into this place. They're like, what the hell is going on with me? And then it gets potentially misdiagnosed as some sort of psychological pathology when in reality, like, it's this thing that happens.
Yeah. Or if they come from some sort of like cultural background or like a religious background that makes them believe, you know, oh, the devil's coming for me or any of these things, you know, it can be, you know, that's why I think it's important to have stuff like the Mind Illuminated or even Daniel Ingram's book, which, you know, gives out the stages. This is going to happen when you do this. Be prepared.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's good to have the information despite the drawbacks that are obvious, but you can't avoid, you know, misinterpretation. Yeah. Misutilization of these things, like for better or worse, it's out. So I was very actually happy for those things because it illustrated that this was real and that what I was experiencing was normal. So there was one point like at work, like the specific day I still remember very vividly where I was hearing these tones and then all of a sudden I had the sense of looking at my hand and just feeling like I actually wasn't in control of my body.
Oh, wow.
That the whole thing was being automatically run. Like my total experience was automatic. And I was just along. I had the sense that I was merely along for the ride. It was so viscerally terrifying and simultaneously amazing that it felt like I was like, holy shit. Like this whole thing is happening without my input. So stuff like that was like really disorienting, but also like reminded me of experiences with psychedelics, you know, just sort of like these moments that are like very reminiscent of the ebb and flow of a psychedelic trip. And so it just kept gaining steam, which was pretty awesome.
So I assume then at some point there was some sort of, you know, kind of, I suppose, pinnacle or center to this kind of work, and that was there some sort of awakening or some sort of sudden satori or something at that point? Or did it, was it just like a constant unfoldment, or how was it going?
Yeah. I mean, I would say in retro, you know, like in the grand scheme of things, there's definitely an unfoldment, but, it just was very predictable. And so I actually have a theory too, because a lot of times like people talk about this issue of scripting. So like they read a map, And then they sort of project that experience onto what's happening. And but yes, then what yeah. I started to like interpret that as like, oh, like actually that could actually be magical reinforcement. So like you,
oh yes,
you,
yeah,
you get exposed to this idea, and then all of a sudden, because you treat it seriously, it starts to materialize in your experience. And because you're plugging into a specific tradition by way of specific practices, you're sort of aligning yourself with the life force of that tradition. And so I actually never really cared whether or not it was scripted, because it was very real and happening. But essentially, like, there's the description of cessation, which is like the blinking out of experience. And it's like, it sort of is like if you pulled out the plug on your monitor, and then right. it's just like, you know, it's like, and then like yeah. everything disappears and it flicks. And that happens like in all your sense spheres. So you're like, oh, that's obviously very weird. But it's also very, it was very understated. Like,
okay. It sounds like something that could never be understated. It's like you go, oh, right, that was.
But if you imagine, like, if your lights flashed off in your apartment, right? Like, if it was, like, yes. dead, yeah. like if you, yeah. it was dead quiet in your house, like in the middle of the night, and you were watching TV, and if, like, for a split second it came off and came on again.
Yes, yes. Yes.
You would be like, oh, that was weird, but whatever. So it's sort of like that.
Right,
but then it's accompanied by like peacefulness and positive right. mind states, you know, this. And so it was interesting because in the relationship, things were getting increasingly tense, because I think, you know, despite the fact that my partner was into weird stuff as well, they were like, hey, we have to like build careers and make something of ourselves and, you know, have extra money. It seemed like my basically going in the opposite direction to take care of my own well-being was right. putting on a lot of tension. So I would be experiencing like, oh, like a lot of equanimity or whatever, which, you know, could end up becoming spiritual bypassing, because you sort of enter equanimity to avoid your issues, you know, which is a
right.
problem.
Yes, 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 yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I just remember being like, oh, well, I have a lot more peacefulness and clarity, which was really beneficial. So that was basically the start of stuff getting weird.
Right. Yeah, that was just the beginning.
That was just the beginning. Yeah. So.
So was it the realization, I suppose, then that you were getting these insights or whatever word we want to put to it,
yeah.
But it wasn't fixing the problem that you started the practice for, which is your relationship wasn't getting any better, in this, which seems to be, or it wasn't, I suppose, you know, you're getting, in a sense, a bit of the opposite of what you were looking for. You know, you were getting pulled away further away from it, in a sense. Would I be right in saying that at that point?
I would say, so basically, like, within this specific Theravadin map, there's four paths is how they break it up, and all these different maps have different, they define specific levels and stages with specific qualities. So basically for me it was like, oh well, if this is what I think it is, it would be first path. There was all these other ones to go, so there was still like the carrot dangling in front of me.
Okay.
And so basically there was so much interest, and I was like, well, I want more of this good stuff. So I remember at like one point, like I was like experiencing the levels of joyfulness that like being on psychedelics, like looking, like I remember one time I was in the shower and I was like washing my hair, and I looked at my hands and it was very soapy, and I was like remembering looking at the bubbles and being like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like, just like, reality is so awesome. So basically for me, I was like, there's no other game in town, baby. I was like, let's just do this meditation thing.
Yeah.
And that became the primary concern that I had. So that's the quality. I just felt like I was being drawn forward into something awesome. So
right.
it continued to get better and better. You know, it continues to get better and better.
And how was your life then at that point? How was that reflecting? Were you becoming more kind of introverted, I suppose? Or like, were you pulling away from life, or was your life continuing on as normal? Like, if you're doing 2 hours of meditation today and getting, weirdness at work, there has to be, I suppose, some sort of effect to it.
So what ended up happening was, so I had a really good group of, I have a good group of friends that are locally that we would support each other. So my social life was still very active. So we would hang out and practice together, and I would meet up, we would meet up several times a week, practice together. So I had a really, all of a sudden, like a new group of friends became very strong and very prominent. And so that was very supportive. A lot of times, like when you see people online, they don't really have that level of support. And so a lot of it for me is because we were all doing this together, I actually attribute a lot of my success to this group of friends because, you know, when you mutually practice and, you know, you normalize things that are weird, I felt very supported. And then I also had a lot of really strong friendships. So I actually didn't become more introverted despite the fact I was spending so much time practicing. It just ended up taking the place of time that I would spend on other things like video games or reading or whatever. So that basically just got replaced. But what was my life then from then on? It got wacky because all of a sudden, like because the depression started to dissipate, that in that regard, I accomplished what I wanted to do. Depression eradicated. Like, you know, from that point, like it was gone. Cause I was on SSRIs. And at one point we went on a retreat and I forgot my SSRIs and I was like, I'm done taking these. Yeah. I went on retreat. That was the second time I experienced what I interpret as second path within the system. But there was like a magical influence on why that happened as well, which we can get into in a moment. But, but yeah, I was like, yes, I'm not depressed anymore. The life with my reality was really vibrant and very lively. So at that point, I had a lot more energy. So I was actually, things got pretty intense because I sort of felt so happy. I had like a devil may care attitude. So for a while, I was like, I'm just going to run around and do whatever I want. So we ended up separating and stuff. And so then I lived on my own and at that point, like I was an editor for a poetry press, a local poetry press. So at that point I was like, yes, my life is mine again, you know?
Okay.
So,
so like a whole, literally a whole new lease on life, like that, that kind of, is that how it felt? Yeah,
exactly. It exactly felt like a new lease on life. And so even though I didn't know how it was going to unfold and I was still very sad and, you know, don't get me wrong. Like I still had outbursts and stuff like when we were breaking up and it was still like, very painful experience for a long, long time, but it's still I had this new lease on life and this new appreciation and got what I was looking for at the time. So there would be a lot more points in which there would be a lot of striving and angst about the path and the spiritual path and practice, but for that point, it was quite amazing.
Right. Was it like when you were doing this? At this time, had you, like, were you working under a particular teacher or was it all kind of self-driven or group-driven or, you know, what kind of, or were you just kind of letting the practice be the teacher kind of a thing?
So there was a lot of levels of support. So basically, like, I felt pretty confident in my ability to be honest when I was reading The Mind Illuminated, gauging. Because it's easy to like inflate like your practice. You're like, oh, sure. I want to move on to this stage, but you're not really moving anywhere, so it's pointless. So I felt pretty honest with myself in terms of like, okay, this is the book is really well written and well detailed. So like on one level, I was honest with myself with where I was at. Two, I had this group of friends. So like in the spirit of pragmatic Dharma, there's a lot of like peer-based support networks. Plus, I had a teacher who was this, who was a close student of Chula Dasa, the author of The Mind Illuminated. Basically I saw like, we were close for a while and basically he helped me to stream entry first path. Okay. And then at that point I didn't really feel like I needed him as a teacher anymore. So I had a variety of support groups.
Right. So you mentioned there that you had a magical influence on your on a retreat, this the one where you forgot your antidepressants. Was that kind of more when the kind of magic started coming in, or is that again in hindsight that you're aware that it was a magical influence? Like,
no, absolutely, that became a lot more explicit. So at this point, what I started encountering online is because I had this influx of energy. And, you know, just like there's like, you know, like with the relationship stuff, like there's like matters of concerns and contemplating like sexuality and romance and love. And just like what I was noticing on Reddit, for example, at the time, and that's changed, of course. So it's not meant to be defining the specific subreddit called Stream Entry, is that people weren't really in touch with Eros. They weren't really that comfortable with sexuality. So a lot of the vestigial attitudes of Theravada Buddhism, the renunciate attitude and orientation, despite being practiced by modern people on Reddit, it just wasn't very supportive in that regard. And I didn't want them to be like, oh, like you have to like eradicate lust. You have to, you know, contemplate the corpse, you know, like there's all these different exercises that are supposed to, reduce the strength of lust so you can operate, you know, positively. So I was like, you know, like you guys don't seem very sophisticated in this realm. So I started to become very angsty in that way, you know. So I started to learn about other traditions in Buddhism, which I didn't know about at all. Okay. And so then I started becoming more familiar with Tibetan Buddhism and Vajrayana. And so there's a specific practice called deity yoga.
Okay.
That I was like, I was very intrigued by what deity yoga is. And for those who don't know what deity yoga is, basically in Vajrayana Buddhism, there's a whole pantheon of gods and goddesses and bodhisattvas who live in an imaginal realm, a Buddha realm. And basically, like, they sort of reflect ourselves and our constitutions and our attitudes, our personalities. So, like, if you're peaceful, if you're wrathful, if you're more intellectual, if you're more heart oriented, there's a Buddha for you. Okay. And so basically you generally you have to go through a ritual traditionally in Vajrayana to get permission to practice with specific Buddhas.
Okay.
So it's more like, it's like a formal ritual, magical ritual where you are given, it's like an introduction. You're like, hey, we're going to do this. You now have permission to practice with this Buddha. But because at the time there's a lot of requirements generally.
Okay.
So I was like, well, I want to just try this practice anyway. So I started learning about this teacher. His name is Rob Berbea, and he has a whole body of teaching called the Imaginal Teaching. And is also called Soul Making. So basically what this is, it's sort of like in magical terms, it's like a vision work, or, you know, journeying, basically like going into deep meditation and then sort of evoking whoever you want, like specific figures. Like, so you could do your favorite musician a writer that you like, and you just sort of let it surface. You like let this interaction with whichever figure you want surface, or you imagine any number of things. Like, I have wings, and what's it like to have wings?
So it's like essentially active imagination, Jung's type thing, like that. That's
exactly. And so Rob Berbea was really into James Hillman.
Oh, right.
So okay. That influence is sort of filtered through his Buddhist work. And so he started becoming into more Western stuff. So I was like, screw it, I'm just going to do deity yoga, and just using Rob Berbea's teaching as sort of like a template. And I just had a very playful attitude, a very like artistic attitude, where I imagined myself as a specific Buddha, and I would walk around and I would imagine them as that person, but like within their own physical shape. And then I would just imagine that the sky was the color that it wasn't, and that the roads were different colors, and everything was like super psychedelic. And I would project that onto the world.
I'd say that thing's got a bit strange. That must have had a very big effect then on your life then.
Yeah. So then at that point, I was just like seeing everybody as enlightened, fully enlightened and stuff. And it just started generated so much goodwill, you know, and just like, even though like, it wasn't like, when I would imagine things, they would literally look like that. But my mind would perceive it looking like that. So it's that weird thing where, like, I see it, but I don't see it, but it's there because your mind is trying to manifest it. But while on retreat, doing this practice, so I was like carrying this, like I was basically just doing it all the time, like 24/7, just imagining wherever I was this Buddha. Everybody I saw was a specific Buddha. When I was on retreat, I was very angry for some inexplicable reason and very frustrated and just sort of felt like a rabid beast. And at one point when I was sitting, this Buddha appeared to me and was sitting 6 or 7 feet across from me. Like I literally felt their presence.
Okay.
And it got really strange because this specific Buddha form is male, but basically what ended up happening, it started shape-shifting and then it merged with me. Like there was this very tangible sense of this Buddha merging with me. And then it led to like a very powerful, there's these states called jhanas and mm-hmm. Buddhism where like deep absorption states. And I saw like my entire field of vision was white light. So at that point, that's when I was like, oh, magic is real, because I had this very tangible sense of this Buddha being in the room. It wasn't just like, oh, like I'm just imagining that.
Room. No question. Just actually happened kind of a thing.
Right. Because, you know, like when people are skeptical about magic, they're like, oh, well, didn't you just see that? Or you think you saw that? Like you imagined it? Like, no, there's a difference. It's like, different than like somebody across the room is there. You don't question that they're there.
So would that have been your becoming invincible moment in the kind of Gordon White sense of things? You know, the bit where you can't go back to the way you were, like that's it, magic exists. There's no, you know, you can't pretend it doesn't now.
Yeah, I would even say even before cessation, like when I started seeing that stuff was becoming really weird and like malleable, that's when it was. But right. Yeah, okay. For sure.
Yeah.
Because as I was reading about when I was learning about the imaginal work, I was also starting to learn about magic as well. Side by side.
Yeah.
So like I would read a lot of the standard gateway texts, you know, like Liebernol and, you know, like High Magic.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know anything about magic at that point. I didn't know what Kabbalah was. I didn't know about chaos magic. I didn't know about Golden Dawn. I didn't mm-hmm. know about Aleister Crowley at all. There was just never any reason for me to know about them.
Because
My heritage is I'm half Asian, so I always had like this Asian leaning, you know, like
all
these other things. So then like the Western stuff was totally new to me, which was really fun to learn about at the time and just totally experiment along the way.
So is that then the magic kind of stuff then at that point? Did that get you towards say the Alan Chapman and the Magia stuff, or did that happen differently, or how did you end up? I assume you ended up around Wiser by Design, or was it previous? Mm-hmm. So how did you get to Alan Chapman then? I suppose that's the question.
So yeah, basically, you know, I had a voracious appetite at the time to try everything, mm-hmm. whether it was Buddhism and then magic. I just started trying all the books that I could find. You know, so basically, it was like, okay, what are the top occult books? You know, type that into Reddit. What comes up, you know, and then, you know, people dump like these huge drive, you know, all these huge files that have like hundreds of books.
Yeah. No one has ever read ever.
Nobody's ever read. Right. You know? So, I tried a bunch of different stuff, like, Initiation into Hermetics was one that I really liked for a long time.
That's, Jason Newcomb, isn't it?
Franz Barton. New Hermetics.
Yes.
But yeah, Newcomb he's inspired by Barton.
Yeah. Barton's very dry, doesn't he? He's
super dry. There was something about it that I liked because it reminded me of The Mind Illuminated. It's like very self-driven.
Right, yes.
And because a lot of the exercises were very much like things that I was already practicing, like body breathing, for example. I was like, oh, okay, I can. And I actually had some really awesome stuff happen when I was doing Franz Barton. Like he does like elemental breathing. And I remember one day I was in a sauna and I was doing water breathing and I had goosebumps in a dry sauna and chill. I was like, holy shit, that's amazing.
Nice.
So then one of the books, was Advanced Magic for Beginners. So, yeah. You know,
the infamous, you know, like
the infamous, right? So when I remember reading it, I was like, who is this grumpy old man?
Yeah.
It's so funny. He just seems like this salty dog. Like, you know, like.
Yeah, it's like I recently put up a meme of Alan on Facebook, and it was like, you know, the five steps how to do magic, and everyone was like, yeah, fine with the magic bit, but no way is that Alan Chapman. He's a grumpy old man, you know. It's totally. Not this kind of 30-year-old mid-30s, whatever the photo was taken. Yeah, he really is old salty dog energy in Advanced Magic for Beginners.
Yeah, you know, he was just like super snarky, and because you know like I love comics, and so like it's some of like the writing reminded me of like the Vertigo writers, you know, like,
oh sure, yeah
like,
yeah,
Grant,
yeah,
Morrison, you know, like, yeah. So like, because I'm not usually exposed to like the you know to the Europeans that much, so it was like the language and the slang and stuff was like really humorous to me, so I found it quite endearing. So then it was like, oh well, what's this guy up to now? And then, you know, I would check every once in a while, and then that's when I discovered that he was doing Wiser by Design. I didn't really practice a lot of the stuff in Advanced Magic for Beginners, just because I had already been messing around with Chaos Magic prior. But when I saw that he was doing Wiser by Design, I was really intrigued, because I was like, oh, well, he's moved away from, you know, you know, magic, like Chaos Magic style practices. Yeah. And then he was concerned about establishing a Western wisdom tradition, and I was like, well, what even is a Western wisdom tradition?
And that's, so you went from Advanced Magic Beginners to Wiser, so there was no, like, you didn't, no Baptist Head books in between, or anything. So it was a huge jump from Chaos Magic to the, you know, the Western magical tradition awakening type things. Whereas, you know, if you had been following, I suppose, along, it's probably not as big as a jump, although it's still quite a jump, I suppose.
Yeah, so for me, like, I would say like magical practice was like extracurricular activities where I would still like, I was still primarily concerned about finding a right Buddhist teacher. So I was like, okay, obviously Vajrayana is the way I want to go. I have to try to find a teacher in that way. And so I started, for 2 years I was practicing with a modern Vajrayana school called Dharma Ocean. But the whole time, like, I was just never very satisfied with, you know, I would see all these teachers, and so I would just try to hope that I would find somebody, because what I noticed when I was practicing magic was, you know, weird stuff would happen. It was really cool. But personally, it sort of felt like I was like treating magic like a prostitute. Like, I would just be like, oh, I want this thing. I demand that I have it. And it just started to feel really hollow to me, despite the fact that, like, clearly reality was magical. And so basically I began to appreciate the fact that, like, oh, Vajrayana is the magical Buddhist, you know, lineage. I'm going to go with that. And basically my magical practice was, I wanted to become more awakened, and I also wanted to help people awaken and also just contribute to a more positive world. So all that energy, you know, so I would do different magical stuff, but it never became primary, although it was still very much a part of my life. So I guess, you know, my sense of extracurricular is still like, well, that's still maybe heavy duty, you know?
Yeah, I suppose it's hard. It's a hard kind of way to delineate the magic from your life, because you start being magic rather than doing magic. And, you know, so where it's like, people say, oh, have you done much magic recently? Because, well, I haven't done many sigils, if that's what you're asking. But, like, my approach is very magical, which I think is what you're kind of pointing at there.
Yeah. I actually remember, reading at some point, like, Grant Morrison talked exactly to that. Because, like, you know, Invisibles was, like, his hyper sigil.
Yeah.
But then at some point, like, he was just like, I don't need to do magic. I am magic. And that idea, even early on, was like, yeah, that resonates with me personally. And you know, a lot of people treat magic as an art, so like they use it as like artistic expression, so like there's lots of things, you know, magical practice is very broad, but yeah, at some point it stopped making sense to separate it as like this explicit thing I would do versus how things already are.
And that's kind of, I suppose, in a sense the backbone of, you know, living in a magical universe or world or existence or whatever. So just getting back to the Wiser, did you when you found it, were you like, here it is, this is what I'm looking for? Or was it, you know, were you skeptical? What was your kind of initial thoughts about the whole thing?
So a lot of it was like, it was not, this was it just yet. It was right. very much like, I love a lot of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I actually quite liked the website and I liked a lot of how it was structured. I thought it was interesting and the practices were different. So like, I very much, you know, when I heard about the Holy Guardian Angel initially in my studies, like, oh, that seems really awesome. It really resonated with me. Mm. And so when I first encountered the Beloved practice in that manifestation, I was like, oh, this is sort of scratching that itch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the thing is, like, at the time, dialectic practice was so complicated.
And, oh.
You know, and it really sucked that it was really tethered to the website.
Yeah.
And I just never really felt super confident that I was doing it well. Mm. And fire practice felt very familiar to me because of Buddhist practice, because eventually I started getting into like Mahamudra and Dzogchen. And so the fire practice felt very familiar, but the analogy was still unique. And so I appreciated that. But when I was learning the Beloved, that form of the Beloved practice, it just felt like a mouthful and it wasn't really connecting to the heart.
It was a mantra and beads at that point, was it, if I'm remembering correctly?
Like, yeah, my pure sense of self, you know, yeah, I forget what it was, but it just never really gelled for me. And he would talk about cosmological practice and it made no sense to me at the time. So at some point I was really struggling within Dharma Ocean because it wasn't turning out the way I was hoping it would. And then Alan was talking about all of these things that nobody would talk about, like transmission, for example. Like he had all those Wiser Q&A videos and I was just like, he is talking about things that nobody else is talking about. Like, for example, there was one video where he's like, why does it take some people more to awaken than others? You know, and he was like, it's not happening if it's not happening. Like, it doesn't matter if you're clocking X amount of time on the odometer. And that was the whole thing with shadows. Like, you could think you're a good practitioner, but in reality, like, nothing's happening. And then that exacerbates people's level of frustration because they expect things should have happened sooner. Yeah.
But I've done 10,000 hours. You know, why aren't I an awakened being?
That's the level of mastery, you know. Yeah. You know, 10,000 hours, that's it. You know, a lot of people have that attitude.
And sure. And, you know, understandably, you know, given, you know, we have the kind of thing of that, if you haven't achieved something, it's because you haven't put the right effort in. You know, that is kind of a big Western thought, I suppose. But it doesn't help when it comes to meditation and awakening.
Oh, not at all. And that attitude, you know, I've seen a lot of people, you know, because for a while on Stream Entry, I would sort of act as like a spiritual friend for people who needed help. And I would just see like people would get so stuck and they just would turn up the effort. And that just often makes it worse. Like the effort, you know, because all this Western notions of success get kind of tied into it. And it's like very, very, it can be very, very bad. So basically at one point with Wiser, I was like, you know what? Like I'm super into what Alan is talking about. I really like what's going on. But at the point there was four or five different stages of the curriculum and fourth was forthcoming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so basically like I was waiting, I was like, okay, I'm going to stick a pin in this. I'm going to wait until the fourth one comes out and we'll see if that will sort of tie everything together. What ended up happening is Wiser by Design did not complete, but then Majir came out. Yeah. And then at that point, I was like, yes, this is it. Which was very surprising to me because I was like doggedly trying to find the teacher for me in Buddhism. And I met a ton of people and I tried a bunch of different things, like the Diamond Approach, for example, and found some local Sufi orders and stuff and really was hoping to find something. But it was just such a pain in the ass, man. Like it just was such a painful thing. And I was also confused. I was like, why is there so much of a struggle here? It just feels so ridiculous to struggle over this thing, because early on I felt so like self-sufficient. I would be like,
yes, you know, oh yeah, yeah.
I was like, I had the training book. I was, you know, at some point, like, you need more help, you know what I mean, from people. And I was just very frustrated because I would meet people and I'd be like, I don't know if you can really offer me what I'm looking for.
And was it mostly that the people you found didn't have the answer you wanted? Like, they just didn't have the expertise in it. Yeah.
And some people had the expertise. Like, they were obviously very awakened, but it just, it's like falling in love, you know, like finding your teachers, like falling in love, where, like, you know, you can, this person's attractive, or like they can check off all these boxes on your like ideal list, but there's still that something that's not there. So I encountered, I was very fortunate because living in Seattle, you know, there's a lot of options. There's always teachers coming through. There's all these people around that are doing stuff and it's very interesting. And despite that was what was frustrating, because I was like, this should be satisfying.
Yes. Yeah.
This should be scratching the itch. But I was just getting increasingly fed up. And then when Majir came along, it just was like, I've come home.
Right. Okay.
And so, you know, we've talked about the storm and just wanting to come home. And
sure.
At that point, the sense of coming home was very immature. Like, it was very undeveloped. But at some point, I was just like, ah, you know, like, however this is going to unfold, I don't need to grind anymore, you know, over the search, like, let go of this aspect of the seeking, you know. And it was really surprising.
There's a bit in the beginning of it where it mentions this, going like, you know, this kind of acknowledgement that you found it, but you don't really understand it. And I think knew that, you know, and it took me a while to kind of get around it. But I think some people I've talked to, when they get to the storm, which is it's a story within, near the end of the audio teachings or the teachings in general, when they get to that line, you know, the wanting to come home thing, is that's, I think, for me anyway, definitely, right, well, here I am, that this has pointed, big hand coming down, pointing right into my heart, going, this is it!
Totally. Yeah, and I remember, you know, initially, because, you know, Alan wasn't very available during Wiser, but I remember, he was, like, basically non-existent. So then he started to become more available, and I just felt super awkward, like, will you be my teacher? And, like, this fear of rejection and, like, looking like a dummy, you know? Because, like, with all the other teachers, like, I just didn't feel self-conscious, but now I was like, I felt like an awkward teen. And, you know, he's like, well, do you feel home or not? Like, am I your teacher or not? You know? And so it just, I was like, oh, that's an interesting way to phrase it, you know? And so then it took a life on its own, which, even within the last year and a half since the teaching came out, has, there's been a lot of growth and a lot of things that have changed since I started engaging with it. And so it was super surprising, because, like, you know, the silent knowing takes you through this journey, and I, like, had this specific idea of what I wanted and what I was looking for. And as I've come to learn who the ancestors of this lineage are, I'm like, I'm not familiar with most of these people at all, you know?
Right.
And so it's this weird thing where I'm just like, you know, it's like this, your family, but you don't know them, you know? Yeah. So it's just this weird thing, like, very unpredictable, very unusual, and very amusing for that reason.
So Margie, is that like where you're firmly centered in, or are you keeping a couple of other practices in your back pocket, or what's your practice today look like?
Yeah, so basically, you know, it's funny because I think sometimes people come to this point and they're just like, I've done enough experimenting. Like, I did so many different things. And, you know, so many novel experiences arise out of that. But after a while, like, it loses its appeal to just do those things for the sensationalism, I guess, or just for entertain, you know, recreational aspects of magic. And for me, at this point, it's all I do. It's like basically the three practices and binding practice are all I do. Because, like you said, the clarity of magical reality, that we are magical. I remember listening to a Ramsey Dukes interview on Rune Soup where he very much talks about this idea. Yeah, I forget which interview it was, but just like at some point you don't really need to do magical acts in this explicit way, because if your intention and your mind are leading the way, that's all that you need. So, you know, like things like writing or setting intentions, I see them as magical acts, or prayer, you know, like, so nothing like, and that's why initially I was drawn to cast magic, because although it would be super fun to like dress up and play wizard, there's a part of me, like the minimalist in me, is like, oh man, that requires too much setup. get these ingredients, or like, you know, and living in the city, it's hard to have like a, you know, a remote space to do things, you know?
I think like the thing, you become more and more that it's the, you know, the idea, as we were saying, that, you know, magic just becomes what you do. But I do, I have noticed that kind of when you sort some of your stuff out, you know, your shadow stuff, or your, you know, the places where you're being an asshole, or, you know, your shadows in the Mergea sense, that certain things in your life kind of seem to click in a different way that wouldn't have clicked before. And so in a sense, the necessity of things that you would normally may have from a chaos magic point of view, you know, do a sigil for or a working for, it's not as relevant because the path is a bit clearer or something, that, you know, you're not, you don't have to force it as much. I think that's probably a good way of expressing it, that, you know, and it, but it's not going with the flow, man, either, you know.
Yeah. So that's a very accurate way of describing it, for sure. Because it's like, you know, like in Magira speak, it's like, oh, we usually come at things from an absence. So like if you're trying to cast a sigil or you're doing a specific magical ritual, you're hoping to actualize something. But if something is operating underneath that, that is sabotaging you without your knowing it, when you have a persistent sense of lack and frustration because you're like, okay, yeah, I got the 10 bucks or whatever, you know, like, it's like, okay, well now what, you know, I always had this feeling of like, now what, I would do this sigil, now what,
wait till the next disaster.
And it just felt kind of exhausting, and I just felt sort of lazy, you know. And then, you know, when I was doing divination, I would just be like, okay, like, there's a part of me that would feel like a schmuck for doing divination, because I'd be like, okay, like, I'm just trying to get an answer so that I'll feel okay about a situation.
I'm looking for the answer that I want, really. So, you know,
And when you interact with oracles in that way, they know. And so, like, it's like the diminishing returns. It's like, it's just sort of like, I'm done with you. You know, like, you're like, you know, like, I don't need to, you know, you're not getting a message of some sort. It, you know, like, there's just that lack of charge or like aha-ness that when you sort of treat divination that way, it's like, I'm trying to sniff up these trees, but there's nothing to find here. So when I've done bindings that are successful, they've actually had very intense magical ramifications. Like they, reality, like something really shifts and things change and weird synchronicities would come up and I'd be like, holy crap, you know?
I sort of
imagine like when you bind a shadow, it's like, if you imagine like a string with a ton of knots on it, all of a sudden it's like the knots undo themselves. And then
It's a very interesting thing. And it's, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I found that it, the things, the bindings, say, well, are in one particular area, you know, say they're to do with relationships or whatever it is. But then you notice that it has an effect on your work and you go, but they don't seem connected. And you go, oh, well, they are in some way, you know, that it seems to be a whole, I suppose it's not all separate things. It's one big system. And I mean, of course, we know that too. But it's an interesting one, that it's how the thing is, you said, the underlying current of what you have, you know, you can do all the sigils you want, but if ultimately underneath it you think you're a piece of shit who doesn't deserve money, wealth magic's probably not going to work too well for you, you know. So you should deal with you know, these issues. And but that's a kind of a thing that what I was really drawn to in the Mergea stuff and the Wiser was that in most magic things and most magic kind of teachings, there's never really let's try to be better people section. You know, it's all about, oh, you know, how to get your ex-boyfriend back, or, you know, how to curse your enemies, or how to become, you know, rich and famous or whatever. Yeah. Not quite as bad as that, but it's a lot about getting the things, whereas, like, how, you know, let's try not to be an asshole anymore. What about that? You know, which is, I think, is the most important bit, because it answers the you know, all the other bits, the lack.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I couldn't put it better. I mean, the one thing that you said earlier about, like, you do a binding and it seems like it's about a specific problem, but then you realize, like, oh, all these other things. All of a sudden, like, I would do a binding and then some sort of unrelated situation would avail itself and be like, oh, wow, this is now becoming resolved. So for me, like, really fraught relationships with my siblings, for example, have miraculously corrected themselves,
right?
You know, and it's like unbelievable, because if you know if you present this practice to people, you're like, how is that magic? You can't really appreciate the effect it has until you do it. Like, you can sort of, if you look at the way it's structured, you're like, oh, okay, I can see how it's helpful, because you see this pattern of behavior that sabotages you. Okay, I can sort of understand how that leads to, like, an understanding of the situation, which is all true.
Yeah.
But then the actual magical effect of doing binding and how that manifests in all these really unpredictable ways is really mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And very satisfying. Yeah. So everything that you said was really on point for me as well. So you sort of get drawn forward through, you take care of this thing on its own time, and then this next thing comes up and it sort of just works itself out.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, the thing, like, you're talking about, like, the being a good person, you know, like, as you work these situations out, it's like, especially during these times, it's like, you know, you can say, oh, I want material wealth and I want security, but real security is having the support of your friends. You know, like, what if something bad happens to you during these times? Like, you can't, that sort of wealth is priceless, to have the support of your loved ones and your friends, and when you need it, you know, much more than, you know, just a stack of cash can be. You know, what good will a stack of cash can be, you know, in the apocalypse?
Well, that's it. And I mean, the mini apocalypse, I suppose, we're kind of going through, has really shined a light on things like that, you know. And I hope, like, I was very kind of optimistic that this would be a great kind of learning period for us all. And then you come to the kind of now and you go, well, maybe no one's learning anything. But certainly for me, it's, you know, really been a testament to things like that. You know, what is wealth? And wealth isn't money in the bank. Wealth is, you know, is your friends, is your support, is, you know, even your own ability to survive something, you know, it's your resilience and things like that. Money in the bank's nice too, don't get me wrong.
Oh, totally. And that's a funny thing too, is, like, you know, historically in my life, very unhealthy relationship to money and debt, and then, you know, a lot of it, you know, is being in an ideal, you know, partnership now, and just having a really good partner now, and having an alignment there. But, you know, my situation, you know, what's funny about coronavirus and stuff, yeah, there's been lots of challenges, of course, emotionally, you know, the social isolation. But on the other hand, I have been doing very well, like, and, you know, having a lot of financial security, actually doing way better. You know, I'm actually doing better during the pandemic than I ever have.
Yeah.
And it's not like I had, like, I'm not even doing a new job or anything, but, like, something shifts.
Yeah.
And then I feel really taken care of. So there's something that Alan talks about. He talks about, through practice, when we bring the divine into the center, then our life unfolds from that. And that's sort of become really obvious to me in practice. Like, I don't need to worry about all these problems. If I just engage life and have a practice, it's going well, you know, and I'm just so grateful for that. It's really amazing to really taste the benefit of that, and see how powerful magic is, you know, and the specific style of magical practice, I think, is unprecedented in some way, you know?
Yeah, I think so too.
I think an interesting thing that you just mentioned, was, you know, we would hope that during this time where people have more time to themselves to bake bread or, you know, exercise in their living room.
Yeah.
This would be a moment to contemplate. But unfortunately, that hasn't necessarily panned out in the ways when we see, when we look at social media and we look at the news. When I think about practicing magic, it's also just seeing the magical effects and understanding how things work. So, for example, in a world where, let's say, like in a Western world where people don't appreciate the power of their speech and the power of silence, they'll just blab away, you know, on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, on Facebook, on whatever. People will just blab and blab and blab and get into fights with people. And I see that as like an expression of magic because, you know, the power of the word, you know.
Yeah.
Language is very powerful and potent. And so when people are recklessly using their power that they're unaware that they actually even have, it explains why there's so much agitation, because it's basically like this battlefield, right? And people are just throwing magic missiles all over the place, you know, and, you know, things are exploding this way and that way. But there's a price to be paid, you know? And that's where I'm hopeful, because when people are noticing like, oh, there's all these studies now, like social media makes you depressed, or people are finding themselves trying to disembed themselves from the
information, the hive mind,
the hive mind, you know, there's something that feels wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and if we say that's a silent knowing, it's like, oh, look, the silent knowing is articulating like, hey, this is, despite our addiction to these things, you know, these malevolent forces that are, you know, commodifying us. It's like, something is saying no. And that's where I'm sort of hopeful, despite the fact that it looks pretty awful in a lot of ways right now. But some awareness of at least respecting the power of language, whether we determine that it's magical or not, and the real powerful effect that has, I think is pretty important.
I think there's an element in it, though, going back to what you said about divination and treating oracles in, you know, in a kind of a flippant way, where to the point where it diminishes the power and the efficacy of, you know, that kind of thing. I think that is also going to start playing out in the speech and the spell and the emanation as a magical kind of missile. I think people will have, and you can see it in some places, that, you know, that people don't seem to understand that, you know, their opinion isn't truth, you know. I don't think we're quite there yet, but there's definitely, you know, the signs are being, you know, there to see, if you want, like, that we're on the kind of the trajectory is, you know, it's about to tip down. And I can imagine, I don't know if it's going to be like the destruction of social media or anything like that. I don't think it's going to disappear overnight. But I think there'll definitely be some sort of new approach to it, or I'm hopeful there'll be some sort of new approach to it, because people are getting very kind of sick and tired, literally, of the experience. And that, again, come back to the Magia thing of getting the opposite of what you look for. It's separating us, you know. It's not bringing us together.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is like, it repeats, right? So like, we have to get the message, right? So like, clearly, like, new studies come out, like the physiological effects, you know, the depression, the fact that, you know, more people are committing suicide at an increased rate. Like, humanity has to answer that, you know what I mean? At our own peril. And, you know, hopefully we can wise up, like you said, you know, that you're hopeful that people wise up, because it just feels bad. It feels wrong, and at some point you can't ignore it. There's the calling to do it. And like you said, it's not gonna go away, but hopefully, my hope is that people will have a better sense of relating to these things on a personal level, whether it's through practice or some sense of appreciating the detrimental effects, or having a more holistic approach, like if they have a business, like you have to participate if you're a writer or something. Some sort of business person, like, you have to participate in these things, but having healthier boundaries, and then therefore these small tailorings, if you will have a more productive effect. But obviously we don't know, have any clue how it's going to pan out.
No,
wait and see.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for talking to me. I really, really enjoyed it. It's particularly good for me because you come from, you know, most people I speak to and most people I've talked about magic, get into magic and then get into the kind of insight, awakening kind of meditation. Like it's, I've said that at some stage a chaos magician will, you know, will become a Buddhist. But you started off, I suppose, as the Buddhist and became a chaos magician. So it's an interesting perspective.
Or whatever this Western tradition.
Whatever is the correct name for it. Yeah. So thank you very much, and we'll definitely do it again at some point if you're up for it.
And yeah, I'd love it. There's definitely lots of stuff to talk about. Because I have talked a lot about the Buddhist stuff. You know, and by virtue of going over one's history, you start at the beginning, and it emphasizes. Yeah. That when in reality now it's so much different. So
sure. Yeah.
I'd love to chat again at some point if you're up for it.
Oh yeah, we definitely will. Okay, well, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, Tommy. Take care.